Good morning, everybody, and welcome to episode 55. Cannot believe it's episode 55 of our Ask the Experts live monthly Q&A with Sinton's employment team. So it is 10 o'clock. It's the last working Friday of the month. So that means we are live with you for the next 20, 25 minutes or so. In front of you are our speakers today. We have Associate Catherine Hope and Max Winthrop. So welcome to both of them this morning. Usual format, three questions. There are there in front of you. These are questions that you've sent to us over the course of the last month that we are going to happily answer there for you now. Catherine's first, so enough from me. Good morning, Catherine, and over to you.
Thanks, David. Good morning, everyone. Do forgive me if I start coughing. I've got a bit of an annoying cough that might pop out at some point. Thanks for joining us again this morning, the end of March. Where is this year going? We've got three questions, as David said, and the first one is about paternity packages. And the question is, if an employer offers an overall enhanced paternity package, can an employee rely on specific, more favourable parts of the statutory paternity leave rules? Now, this question really is, it's important to look at it. It's against the backdrop of changes to paternity leave, which are due to come in on the 6th of April. So for where children whose expected week of childbirth is after the 6th of April, or where there's a date of placement for adoption on or after the 6th of April, if an employee is eligible, they can choose. So the differences are they can choose to take two non-consecutive weeks, blocks of 1 week, rather than only in one block of either 1 or 2 weeks. And they can also take that leave within the first year after birth or adoption, as opposed to just within the first 8 weeks, which is the current position. In terms of other changes, it also shortens the notice period required for each period of leave. So an employee now just has to give 28 days notice in most cases prior to the period of leave starting. And that will enable families to give shorter notice to accommodate their changing needs as a family. It also allows a father or partner to give notice to vary the dates they may have given. Again, if they give 28 days notice, and again, that enables them to change planned dates at a later stage to best suit their needs. So just going back to that question, having looked at those changes that are coming in, the question here is where an employer provides an enhanced paternity leave, which is overall significantly more beneficial than the statutory paternity leave entitlements. Can the employee rely on the statutory leave requirements? I think it's good to look at this in terms of two examples. So for example, let's say example one, the changes that I mentioned mean that an employee can give 28 days notice of the start date of their leave, as opposed to the current longer notice that's required. So if an employer offers an enhanced package, do they need to allow that employee to give 28 days notice in respect of a 2 week period of statutory leave, or can they require them to give longer notice in respect of a longer period of extended paternity leave, which would include the 2 week statutory leave? Another example of this question would be, now, as you will now be able to take two separate 1 week blocks, as opposed to that being consecutive, if you're offering an extended period of paid paternity leave as part of your policy, can you require that all of that leave is taken in one block, or would you need to allow an employee to take 1 week at a later date if they chose to? So those are the two questions I'll be looking at and scenarios. As a starting point, an employee will be entitled to rely on the statutory rules when it comes to statutory paternity leave and pay. Now, when it comes to an enhanced provision, you can, of course, choose to impose whatever conditions you deem appropriate when it comes to the enhanced part, provided that doesn't go below the statutory minimum and, of course, that it's not discriminatory in any way. Now, in terms of answering these two examples, although you may give varying different enhanced packages, I'm going to look at it as if, for example, you offered an enhanced package of, let's say, 4 weeks leave and at full pay. So in terms of example one, here it could be possible to allow for a statutory minimum, to allow for the statutory minimum position, but impose additional restrictions on the enhanced parts. So you might choose to allow for only 28 days notice to be given to the 2 week statutory leave, but require a longer period of notice in respect of the additional 2 weeks leave that you're offering. That in practice, though, I think there could be some issues with that, because would your policy prohibit an employee who was only given 28 days notice for the statutory leave from taking any of the additional leave, so the additional 2 weeks? And would an employee take 2 weeks statutory paternity leave, then return to work, and then be allowed to take the enhanced period at a later date once the longer period of notice has been given? What you couldn't require is the employee to give a longer period of notice in respect of the 2 weeks statutory paternity, even if your package has overall is more favourable. In terms of example two, when we're looking at taking the blocks as consecutive or in non-consecutive parts, I don't see a problem with, for example, you requiring that to take advantage of an enhanced paternity leave and pay, and the employee must take all 4 weeks in a single block during the first 8 weeks of birth. I think the first 2 weeks could use up the entitlement to statutory leave and pay, meaning there's then no further statutory right that an employee could exercise. I think overall the key point here is going to be making sure that your policy is clear about the options open to an employee and the consequences of the choices they make. For example, if you want to make it clear that if an employee only gives 28 days notice or wants to take leave in two blocks, they will only have 2 weeks in total, i.e. the statutory minimum. If that's the case, that should needs to be spelled out really clearly, as should any consequences in terms of pay. I think otherwise you could risk there being an argument that you've given the enhanced leave and pay, but there's also the flexibility of the new statutory scheme. So it's just being clear as to your policy. So that's the first question. I'll now pass you over to Max with question two.
Good morning, everybody. So can an employee make a request to work fully remotely? Well, there's quite a lot in this question. So probably the best way of looking at it is to sort of unpack it a little bit, first of all. So just reminding ourselves, what are the obligations when it comes to the place of work? Now, I'm sure most of you listening will recall that the place of work is one of those things that has to be set out in the written statement of terms of employment. Now, of course, what we've seen, though, over the last 5 years or so is with the combined effect of suddenly rushing into the need to work remotely over the COVID period, it's often easy to forget that back in the contract of employment itself, there may be differing provisions as to where you work. Now, of course, the contract of employment is what you might call a dynamic document. It changes even without a formal reissuing of the document. For example, we all know that when the salary goes up, very unusual to find anybody complaining about a salary rise, but it may not be reflected in the written document. What I'm finding is that over the last few years, of course, there have been massive changes in the way we work, but they're often not reflected in the contract of employment. They're reflected in what people do. Now, the contract of employment isn't just what goes into writing, it's how people operate. And where people have been working remotely successfully, arguably, that's an express variation to the contract, even if it's not reflected in the written document. Now, let's dive down a little bit further. We all know, though, that even with something that's been set in the print of the contract of employment, there are rights to make requests for flexible working. And one of those flexible working requests can involve where you work. The question relates to how far can you go with regard to fully remote working? Now, I suppose the answer to that will depend on individual contract and the function that somebody performs under it. A request to work flexibly, we used to see these almost exclusively in terms of the hours of work, but they do include the place of work as well. Ultimately, is a matter of the employer can say, well, hang on a minute, it's just not going to work flexibly in the way that you suggest. Part of your function maybe supervisory. There may be other reasons why the employer can say, well, I can let you have up to 3 days a week working remotely, but 2 days is too much. And therefore, I'm afraid your request is going to be declined. Whether that works will depend on the circumstances of the case. Delving down a little bit further as well, I'm sure a lot of you listening will be aware that there are changes coming up. Now, at the moment, the right to make that flexible work request is dependent upon 26 weeks of employment. Come the 6th of April, that all changes. And interestingly, the right to make that request becomes a day one right. This is quite interesting from the point of view of what are we going to see in the workplace? Are we going to see people signing up to jobs with a particular workplace, and then day one, day two, they ask you, oh, by the way, I'd like to work exclusively from home. Remains to be seen how far that's going to be pushed by a particular employees. Also coming up in terms of changes from the 6th of April with regard to flexible working will be the right to make two statutory requests in a 12-month period. And the employee doesn't need, as they do at present, to spell out what the impact will be on their flexible work request. Responses to those flexible working requests, how you're going to come back and respond to it and say why the request is going to be refused and the reasons for it. At the moment, you've got 3 months. After the 6th of April, that all goes down to 2 months. The new regs also place, probably expect, big emphasis on consultation. You can't refuse it without the consultation process going through. We are promised an ACAS code. It's not yet available, but one expects a new code on this to follow on shortly. But I suppose the ultimate takeaway with the is that there's the right, but it doesn't necessarily follow that there has to be an acceptance of any request. And different jobs are going to require different approaches, different flexibilities, if you like, in what can and cannot be accepted by the employer. So, I'm going to hand back to Catherine now for the next question.
Thanks, Max. So the final question today is, are employees entitled to additional leave if they are a carer? So the question is that from the 6th of April, they will be, and that's because the Carers Leave Act 2023 will be introducing from the 6th of April a new statutory right. And that legislation provides that an employee will be entitled to take up to a week of unpaid leave each year to look after someone who relies on them because they're ill, have an injury, disabled, or have care needs because of old age. And day one, it's a day one right, so there's no requirement to have any particular length of service. So in terms of the time off, as I said, they will have the right to take up to 1 week of unpaid leave in each rolling 12-month period. And that's to arrange or to provide care for a dependent with a long-term care need. So in terms of what a dependent means, it's like the current right to time off for dependents, where a dependent means a spouse, civil partner, child or parent, someone who lives in the same household but isn't a tenant, lodger or boarder or employee, and someone who reasonably relies on an employee to provide care or arrange care for them. And a dependent will be deemed to have a long-term care need if they have an illness or injury, physical or mental, that requires or is likely to require care for more than 3 months. They're disabled under the Equality Act, or they require care for a reason connected with their old age. Now, the legislation doesn't state what type of care this includes, but it's intended to cover a range of caring situations. So you might think things like arranging to take someone to a medical appointment, supporting someone with personal care, arranging visits to with a health professional, or organising care for the future. In terms of the amount of time to take off, it's a maximum of 1 week, and they don't need to be taken consecutively as long as no more than the equivalent of 1 week is taken in each rolling 12-month period. In terms of what a week means, it really depends on the contract of employment for an individual employee. So if you have someone working full-time Monday to Friday, that'll be 5 days, it will be there the 5 days of that normal working week. If they work part-time, it will be their contracted weekly hours rounded up to the nearest half day. If the amount of time they work varies from week to week, a week's leave will be the average of a week's work. So you're looking at the total periods for which they have worked over the last year and dividing that by 52. But if they've not worked for you for a year, you're looking at dividing the total periods for which they were normally required to work during the course of a week by the number of weeks that they've been employed. In terms of what they need to do if they want to take that time off, the notice they need to give is it's a minimum of 3 days or twice as many days notice as the number of days they want to take off. So if they wanted to take 1 day off, they'd need to give you 3 days. But if, say, it's 2 days, they'd need to give you four. So it's twice as days, a minimum of three or twice as many as the days they want to take. They have to tell you that they're entitled, why they're entitled to take carer's leave in accordance with the requirements I've just set out, and specify the days they intend to take and if they want that to be a full or a half day. If, for example, a request is made and the operation of your business would be disrupted if an employee were to take leave on a certain date, you can postpone that carer's leave. And if you need to exercise that right, you do then need to allow that employee to take the carer's leave within a month of the date they made that request, and that's at a mutually convenient time. If this happens and you need to write to that employee within 7 days of the request being made, setting out the reason for the postponement and then setting out the date that's been agreed for them to take that at a different time. What about if an employee cares for more than one dependent? The 1 week that's given under the legislation, it's only there for, that's the maximum regardless of how many dependents someone is looking after. So for example, it's not that someone gets 1 week for each individual dependent that they provide care for, but it doesn't mean they can't obviously use that carer's leave for different individuals. So someone might spend 3 days providing care for one person and 2 days providing care for another to use that maximum. So that's a quick overview of the legislation that's going to come in. Obviously, this is the statutory minimum, so you are obviously open and able to provide something enhanced to that, and many of you as employers will be doing that already. It's just then being clear in your policies, making sure any current policies are updated to at least make sure you're at least providing the statutory minimum. And particularly if then requests are made, but also making sure that those are up to date in terms of the changes that are coming in. So that's us for today. I'm just going to pass you quickly back to Max to give an update in relation to some changes to the vento bans. Thanks.
Thanks, Catherine. So, yeah, well, it's nearly April, and one of the things that, from an employment lawyer's perspective, happens in April is changes to the compensation limits. Now, I suppose very quickly, just to mention that the compensation level for an ordinary unfair dismissal goes up from the 6th of April. Cap will either be 115115. Interestingly, it sounds like some sort of call centre number, doesn't it? But that's 100. Let me get this right. £115,115. So it's gone up from the previous limit of £105,707 or 52 weeks pay. So remember that if it's an ordinary unfair dismissal claim, it's the lower of those two caps. The week's pay figure goes up to £700, which means that our current maximum redundancy pay from the 6th of April will be £21,000. Now, the vento bans have also been increased. Now, just remembering what they are, in a case where compensation is awarded for non-pecuniary losses, generally speaking, talking about discrimination and some types of detriment claim, the tribunal is entitled to award a sum that it assesses on what the claimant has lost because of their discriminatory treatment. And they are, since the case of vento, broken down into three bands. And we have a lower, a middle, and an upper band. And the new figure for the lower band is now from £1,200 to £11,700. The middle band goes from £11,700 up to £35,200. And the upper band now goes to £35,200. £58,700, and if you're £58,700, extremely rare, but there will be exceptional cases where the tribunal can award that amount, but that presidential guidance emphasises, but it's only in exceptional cases that would be the case. Very broadly speaking, I'm sure those of you who've experienced discrimination cases will find that most awards hover somewhere within the middle band. Those bands are creeping up. I should also perhaps point out to anybody listening from Scotland that there are slight differences in the presidential guidance as to how you calculate those bands. So the figures I've given you, the current limits as set out in the presidential guidance for England and Wales. And with that, I will hand you back to Dave to wrap things up.
Thank you very much to both of you. Enjoyed listening to that one. As always, very quickly from me, as I've said at the end of each of these 55 episodes, we're still continuing to work hard to produce, release and deliver useful and relevant content, articles, podcasts, blogs, all of which can be found on our website, www.sintons.co.uk, should you wish to take a look. And as I say, that includes all 55 episodes of this live monthly Q&A session with Sintons employment team. And if you haven't heard enough from us by that point, you can follow the team on Twitter at Sintons Law and at Sintons HR. I have just popped your speaker's details back on the screen there for those of you joining us via podcast. I'll just go through those with you for Catherine, 0191226 3801, catherine.hope@sintons.co.uk. For Max, 0191226 3703, max.winthrop@sintons.co.uk. So that's the detail should you wish to get in touch with anything they've raised today further, or indeed any of the episodes. That's about it from us today. Just wanted to thank you once again for continuing to tune in. I know I say this each time, but we do have record numbers of people in attendance today, which is truly, truly staggering that our little series that we started back in 2020 has just grown and grown and grown into such a stalwart in the calendar each month. So thank you for that. We do genuinely continue to appreciate that. We are so pleased that this continues to add value to you. And I know I've said this so many times, but as long as it does, we will continue to bring these sessions to you each month. On that notice, we will be back with you last working Thursday of April. Enjoy Easter, everybody, and the long bank holiday weekend. Take care, and we'll speak to you again. Thank you once again.